Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined always by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're going to explore a topic of why it takes so long to resolve civil cases in both federal and state courts. And we're going to specifically look at some of the intricate discovery processes that add to that delay. Let me just say, Judge Gale, that I looked up yesterday, and the average federal case takes 2 years and 7 months from filing to coming to trial. And in state courts around the country, there is a minimum of 2 years or even longer if the litigation is complex.
I am not surprised.
You know, I think that, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. Have we overcomplicated the system? Let's ask that overarching question before we get into some of the details. Is it too complex?
No, I think there are definitely some complex issues that can only be resolved in the court. And I think that the more advances that we make, the more complexity will be introduced. For example, you know, we're going to see more and more cases, civil cases, being filed in courts around the topics of artificial intelligence.
Yes.
We're going to see autonomous vehicles on our roads more and more. And so we're going to have, I think, more litigation around the liability
issues. Yep, yeah.
Related to things of that nature. So again, with advancements in any civilized society, I think it's going to breed or invite the resolution of what are now some complex matters because we've not seen them before. And at the same time, while those complex matters are being introduced into the courthouse doors, it's going to be balanced against what I'd like to say some of the, you know, more traditional or native type cases that have always been there. Those are still going to keep coming in. And so the flow of those from, you know, one form or another are going to continue to be met at the courthouses, because although things do resolve sometimes with agreed resolutions and things are negotiated to a resolution, many times in order to just get someone to the table to begin having a discussion about resolving it short of trial or some other form of legal engagement, it means filing the case. And so in order to just get the person to the table or get the entity or the agency to the table, you've got to file the civil case. And it is a slow, it's as my Southern mama would say, it is like, you know, molasses flowing in the wintertime. Molasses is already slow. And if you just add the coolness of winter, it goes even slower. And so that's what this is, you know, somewhat reflective of, is that molasses flowing in the wintertime.
You know, it's also, I think, something that we can help educate our audience about. We normally think, I think the general public normally thinks of a civil case as the plaintiff versus the defendant. And that's it. But we know as judges that the cases can get far more complex than that, and that the complexity is usually the norm. And what we find is plaintiff sues the defendant. Defendant sues the plaintiff. That's called a counterclaim. Defendant brings in another party that's not part of the original suit. That's called a third-party complaint.
Mm-hmm.
That third-party defendant sues the original defendant, and sues the plaintiff. So oftentimes you have, I think one time I had 12 lawsuits in one lawsuit.
Yes.
I had 12 different lawsuits. By the time you added defendants and counterclaims and cross-claims, they can get really complex really quickly. And plaintiff versus defendant is the oddity, not the norm.
Indeed, because it's rarely just or merely that, right? It's not as simple as it perhaps appears. But what I'd also like to say about civil cases that distinguish them in addition to the complexity of them, right? Because again, also, I think I was talking about artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicles. Yep. You know, let's think about medical malpractice and how we see advances in medicine and how, you know, how medicine is moving, you know, in some instances to more robotic care. So you have actual robots that are performing surgeries and whatnot. You know, this is, again, a very, this is complex. And remember, your judges are judges. They aren't often doctors or accountants or, you know, they need the opportunity and the ability to appreciate the highly specialized skill set of individuals that'll come in and essentially educate them about the underlying facts before they can make rulings about the law. And this is the same whether civil or criminal.
Let's take your example of a robotic surgery, for example. You know, and let's say that something goes horrendously wrong in that surgery, and the victim wants to sue people that the victim thinks are responsible. Well, sue the doctor who performed the surgery, the surgeon, but also perhaps the company that designed the robotic surgical instrument. Company who built the robotic surgical instrument, the hospital that's charged with maintaining the surgical robotic instrument. The list could go on and on. It's not just simple, I'm suing the doctor because the doctor screwed up.
And anyone else who may have had any involvement, right? Down to the nurses or...
Yeah, the hospital administration. So in there's no such thing as a simple malpractice case, to use that as an example.
It is not. And I think one thing that we want our audience also to understand and appreciate is another reason why you may see really elongated civil cases is unlike criminal cases, you do not have a constitutional right to speedy trial, right? You don't have the same time restraints that often criminal cases face. So given the, and you can have complex criminal cases. There are many, 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 many complex criminal cases, but there's a trigger in the law that kind of requires you to move things along. And if there is ever, and Judge, I'm sure you've had this experience, if there's ever a circumstance where you may have had a, you know, civil matter on the docket pre-existing and you were intent on getting to this and dealing with some of the issues, the criminal cases will always take precedence. So they have the ability to bump them out of the way. And so what could have perhaps, yes, been resolved in a matter of 6, 9, or 12 months may take up to 2 years, because if you have a criminal matter that takes priority on that day or during that window of time, you're legally responsible and required to take the case that has the constitutional priority, which because criminal cases have a speedy trial trigger, you are more often than not going to take that criminal matter.
And I think our listeners should be aware that most courts, federal trial courts, as well as state trial courts, those trial courts aren't designated as criminal courts and civil courts. Most of the time, those courts handle both kinds of cases. So a judge may have a criminal case one day and a civil case
the next,
or even the same day. That's right. So when we say the criminal cases take priority, they demand the judge's time in these courts that handle both kinds of cases.
Indeed. And you are so right. There are some jurisdictions, however, there are some courts, meaning in some states and some areas, that assign judges to very defined dockets. So you may be in a courthouse where your presiding judge decides whether or not your docket is exclusively civil cases. So all you handle are civil cases for a certain period of time. So maybe you're on a rotation, and as a judge, you have civil cases for the next year. And then the next time you rotate out, you may rotate to juvenile cases, or you may rotate to a criminal docket. You may rotate to a probate docket. It may be, and it is in some jurisdictions, where you do have a rotation of sorts where your docket is exclusively one subject matter or another, which, quite frankly, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because it gives judges an awful lot of expertise in a lot of different areas, meaning they don't need as much education on, from experts on certain subject matters. But it takes a while to build that up. And at the same time, you know, you get judges that are specifically dedicated to certain types of cases. But given, and I think you'll probably agree with me, given the volume that courts are dealing with just about anywhere, I think the issue is also just having enough learned judges to address the caseload, whether it's, you know, civil or otherwise, to do this. What do you think?
You can't be an expert in everything, because I've had medical malpractice cases where I was a judge on, and then turn around and have a case that involves some kind of engineering or physics question.
You're like, this is not my wheelhouse.
you can't be experts in all of those areas. You just have to know how those areas fit into the law.
Precisely.
But we don't, except in certain instances, bankruptcy, tax courts, and so forth, we don't have specialized judges necessarily. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Judges, by definition, are generalists.
Exactly. And that means they will, throughout their careers, they would have heard about or learned about a vast wealth of areas in society for which they had no pre-existing expertise. I had a friend of mine, yep. John Mitchell, he said that he treats his cases like a bathtub. And essentially, you know, the information goes in, and as soon as the case is over, it's over. I mean, he's like, listen, I don't have to hold on to this information. I think how judges are, is that you may have heard, you know, very technical information about a certain subject for one case. And even if that same or similar thing comes up 2, 3, 17 years later, you may need to be educated about that all over again, because there should be no expectation that you've held on to the water in the bathtub. That you certainly took out the plunger, and that it left as soon as the case was over.
Well, one thing that makes civil cases take a long time, is the whole concept of discovery. And we've talked a little bit about this in the past, but I think we need to really get into it. The whole concept of discovery is where one side seeks information from the other side in various forms, whether they're documents, testimony, reports, expert reports, diagrams, whatever the case may be, so that each side knows what the other side has. Now,
no trial by surprise.
There's a sense of fairness to that. That's certainly true. There's a sense of we want everything to be open. But another behind the scenes idea is that sometimes after discovery, cases settle, because they see what the other side has, and they know that your position may in fact be compromised, or it may be risky to go to trial. So you're willing to take a settlement on the case. And I should say right now that 97% of all civil cases that are filed in federal and state courts are resolved prior to a trial.
Wow.
Only 3% of civil cases ever go to trial. That's pretty remarkable.
And part of that,
and part of that is through the discovery process. Even though it's long and arduous, and we'll talk about some of the aspects of it, it is necessary in resolving cases. And I would say it's a cornerstone of justice to have open and really aggressive discovery. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree. I was saying earlier that, you know, I just genuinely, I am absolutely opposed to trial by surprise. I think that each side should come to a case believing in the veracity of their position, but in so doing, you should be willing to lay on the table, almost literally, what it is that you intend to be fighting for so that no one is blindsided. I think it makes for better negotiations and potential resolution. But I also think that as a judge, you know, it keeps the judge exactly where they're supposed to be, not someone having to essentially referee the behavior of the parties by, you know, imposing or threatening to impose sanctions or, you know, or the like, because there are sanctions that a court can impose for not complying with discovery. But I think that it allows the judge to more readily and more easily, quite frankly, help to get the case to resolution, even if that includes trial.
Well, let's look at some of the types of discovery, and these are not in any particular order. Basically, a party who is requesting discovery could use any and all of these at almost any time in the case from its inception. But the first one I want to talk about are interrogatories. Interrogatories is when, say, the plaintiff presents the defendant, or vice versa, defendant presents the plaintiff in a very simple case, a list of written questions that the other party has to answer in writing and under oath. So this is oftentimes the first kind of discovery that's put out so that a party who is requesting the discovery can decide what they need more information about. I want to pursue this avenue more as a result of the answers to the interrogatories. I fancied myself, Judge Gale, as a master of interrogatories. I would write questions, and there, it's so much in the way you write the questions to get the answer that you particularly want. But we're not talking about two or three questions. I mean, I would give a set of 100 or more interrogatory questions.
Oh my gosh, was that routinely designed to aggravate the other party?
Aggravate the other party and run up their attorney fees. Now, this is going to sound like I'm an evil person, but if I'm the plaintiff, I want to run up the attorney fees on the defendant because the defendant will be more apt to settle than pay their attorney. So the more I ask, the more time it's going to take to answer, the more attorney fees that's going to rack up.
That is true. And for some, and I think that's, you know, can be effective. I think the flip side to that is we already see in so many instances where the legal system creates kind of barriers to entry or barriers to accessibility because of cost prohibitions. And for individuals who have legitimate claims, who can't really afford attorneys, and given the abysmal way that we have funded legal aid societies, I think, you know, it can work to preclude them from actually pursuing avenues where the court legitimately should be making rulings and determinations that are beneficial to all people, whether similarly situated or otherwise. But I certainly can understand. I think to everything, there's a strategy. And what you've identified here is essentially a strategy for resolution. Yeah. And also, it will limit the other side just wanting to drag this out. It will almost force the other side to at least start early, to start considering resolution earlier on.
So interrogatories, the usefulness of them, I think they just lead you to want more, or to direct yourself to different documents, or to plan depositions later on. I just think they're a preliminary form of discovery. Would you agree with that?
I think so. But I think, again, depending upon how well-crafted they are and how extensive they may be, how...
Oh, they were extensive.
It sounds like that, whereas they may be designed to kind of begin the conversation, you can start and stop a conversation, I think, with just the right interrogatories, just right there. Just, okay, this is more than a notion. So, and especially again, if it's the one that really, really runs up the attorney fees really quickly, that will oftentimes, that can be a huge consideration as to how long this conversation is going to go on, or how quickly you're going to get to a table to seek resolution.
One of my favorite forms of discovery is the next one I want to talk about, and that's requests for production of documents.
Oh my goodness.
This could be as simple as a bill, a medical bill, for example. Or it can be complex. Let's use our example that you set out, Judge Gale, of the robotic surgery. Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm the defendant, or excuse me, if I'm the plaintiff and I'm suing for malpractice, what kind of documents might I be looking for? And you know, how voluminous are we talking about here?
Oh my gosh. I think in those instances, again, because this is complex litigation, let's tackle the issue of voluminous. I think nowadays so much of the data, because we're not talking about documents as much anymore, we're talking about data that is being housed on computers and servers, that you might be looking at multiple terabytes of data that require an awful lot of review. And in fact, you know, depending upon the size of your shop, your office, you may have an entire team that's dedicated just to reviewing these documents from this particular medical facility. Everything from the hospital's contract with the vendor who created the machine itself, any payments, any documents, obviously, that your client has signed related to this particular experience, maybe even things that are only tangentially related. So how many doctor visits did they have prior to this procedure, and who was the doctor that saw them and recommended the procedure, and any documents related to that? How, you know, you might be requesting information from the insurance company that approved the procedure. Again, these could all lead to adding additional parties to the action, and it may not, but going through all of this. So really, it is like, if you are a connoisseur of puzzles, and you are into putting puzzles together.
I would encourage
you to think of this as a ginormous jigsaw puzzle with the tiniest pieces. And all of these pieces obviously have only one space that they can go into, one place that they fit neatly into. And so your job in going through all of this information and data, and again, it's still called a request for documents. It should, you know, perhaps be called a demand for digitized information, because that's pretty much how all information is transmitted these days. But this is tantamount to literally going through and pulling all of those really small puzzle pieces and putting every single piece where it is supposed to go so that you can understand the big picture and also a chain of events. The one of perhaps the most important things you can understand is what happened with whom, when, and how all of these things link together such that you ended up at the final result. And while you're looking at, you know, what happened with whom, when, you know, what went wrong, at what point did it go wrong, or at what point did it go sideways? And that where's the biggest liability here? And where do you focus your time, effort, and energies?
Well, in back to our hypothetical, back to our example, you know, I think the normal person would think, well, if you're the plaintiff, you want the doctor's records, you want the hospital's medical records, any notes that the doctor made, and you might think that that's all that you need. But when we're talking about robotic surgeries, you're looking at maintenance reports on the robotic surgical machine.
Warranties.
You might be looking at warranties. Mm-hmm. You might be looking at were there times where this machine malfunctioned earlier so that you were not the only one who suffered as a result of this faulty machine. You might be seeking the design notations and diagrams and data, digitized data on the design of the robotic machine to see if it was properly designed or whether it was a design flaw that caused the problem. So you can see it's like tossing the pebble in the pond and all the rings keep going out from that pebble. You could be requesting hundreds or thousands of documents.
Yes, and that's the need for perhaps having a team to review all of those documents. And you're absolutely right. And one thing you were saying when you talked about, you know, what the request could look like when it comes to, you know, the design perhaps of the machine, it's times like that where you might actually face a lot of rebuff from the company itself, who does not want to release what they believe is
proprietary
patented information. And they don't want, you know, even if it is subject to litigation, it, you know, they may very well file a motion with the court seeking to exclude that from the document production, or asking for an alternative way to provide it.
And the judge, we should add, is the referee in this. The judge is the referee to say, you didn't provide the discovery. You need to provide more. You're asking too much. What you're asking is vague. The judge makes those determinations.
Yeah, absolutely. And necessarily so. And a judge may say, hey, listen, I understand the arguments of, you know, going back to the example of requesting or demanding the designs of the machine itself. The judge has a few options, and one could include, you know, a in-camera inspection of the designs to determine what parts of it is proprietary and what isn't, and what can be provided to the other side and what cannot or should not be provided. There are ways to respond to those roadblocks, but that also adds to why this takes a much longer time to resolve than perhaps other cases that might appear in the court, because you at any given time can be met with, you know, a motion or a request to essentially, you know, halt the proceedings for one reason or another.
And also we should note that, you know, in regard to interrogatories and requests for production of documents, particularly, it's not just asking one time. You can have multiple sets of interrogatories, and you can have multiple requests for documents, because one document may lead you to the need to see another document. So that's part of the time frame of why these things take so long.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they can be very effective. The interrogatories and the production of documents, they can help, again, to help frame that, you know, better understanding of exactly what position you'll be taking with regard to the case itself. But in so far as you absolutely love the production of documents, I wonder what your feelings are about depositions that usually follow the production, because you are usually reliant upon the information from interrogatories and document productions in order to conduct deposition. So what are your thoughts about that?
I'll get to depositions in a minute. Let's get a couple of other things out of the way that we can do quickly, because depositions, I think we have to spend some time on. And that's requests for admissions, where one party asks the other party to admit to certain facts. I've never found those useful. Nobody's going to do that. Nobody's going to admit to something. You know, I think that's a waste of time, but it is a form of discovery. Have you ever found that useful?
I don't know that it is. I mean, again, on the criminal side, we call them stipulations.
Yeah.
You could get those a lot quicker. But this, I think that, you know, you are just like, you know,
admit
this
that your robotic machine was malfunctioning.
Right.
No,
that will never happen. But I think the only admission is, you know, that yes, the patient was scheduled for a procedure on this date. that's the admission.
The other form of discovery before we get to depositions is physical and mental examinations. Mm-hmm. When it's relevant to the case, you may require the other party to undergo a physical or mental evaluation. So let's say that the plaintiff is claiming injury from an accident, from a motor vehicle accident, and claiming whiplash or soft tissue injury or something that's difficult to prove sometimes. The defense can request the court to have the plaintiff go to a defense doctor or a defense examiner to examine that person to either verify the injury or to counteract the injury, saying that it's not as serious or it's not permanent, any number of ways to counteract the injury. Those are really open and happen in almost every personal injury case.
Agreed. And you may be able to overcome this or sidestep this if the plaintiff already saw or went to a doctor. It would be interesting if, again, they went to the same hospital where they ultimately received a procedure and was yeah. And then was injured further, but they may very well, this may very well not be necessary if documents similar to that are already available. And the other side believes that, you know, there's no need in the added expense, because even undergoing the physical or mental evaluation, there's a cost related to it. Therefore, back to Judge Tom's point of running up the attorney fees, now there's, you know, the additional expense of this evaluation, which may not be medically necessary in order to achieve whatever the ultimate goal is.
All right. Now to your deposition question. Basically, a deposition, for those who may not know, is the oral examination of a witness or a potential witness under oath prior to the trial. It's like cross-examination in the courtroom, but it's done in a law office with agreement of time with court reporter present. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're videoed. Oftentimes they are not. Now, there are two kinds of depositions. One is a pure discovery deposition, where you're asking questions to determine what was said, who said it, who did this report, you know, really just fairly mundane questions. But then there are also depositions for testimony. And that is, our courts have allowed certain groups of people like physicians or surgeons to not have to come into the courtroom and take their time to testify. Instead, both parties can agree to having that witness examined by both parties prior to trial, usually by video, and then that video is played for a jury or the judge at the time of trial. So, depositions are vitally important. They normally happen later in the discovery process, after you've had the written interrogatories, after you've had the request for admissions, after you've had the request for production of documents, after you've had the physical or mental examinations, but not always. Now, let me give you a current example. President Donald Trump was accused by the Wall Street Journal just recently of sending a bawdy birthday card to Jeffrey Epstein for his 50th birthday. President Trump says he never did it, didn't have anything to do with it, doesn't know anything about it. The Wall Street Journal printed the article anyway. The Wall Street Journal is owned by Mr. Murdoch, who is 94 years old. So,
which I'm sure for him is 94 years young. But
yeah. So what happened was, President Trump decided, I'm not going to take this lying down. So he filed a defamation suit or libel suit, a defamation suit against Murdoch and the Wall Street Journal and all of the reporters and editors who were involved with the story. Now, that has been filed. And by the way, Judge Gay, I don't know whether you saw it, but in the federal documents that show the complaint, the attorney listed for representing President Trump was Donald J. Trump. And he's not a lawyer, so he filed the complaint pro se. Now, you're the Latin specialist. Pro se basically means
on his own behalf.
On his own behalf. He filed the complaint on his own behalf. He was in such a hurry, he didn't even get a lawyer. He filed the complaint on his own behalf.
Well, he's had enough experience. He probably feels like if he's, you know, listened to our podcast and given his own experience, he can handle this himself.
Plus, he knows more than the lawyers and judges do anyway, right? So,
I think if you'd ask him, that certainly would be the response.
He filed this, and the next thing that happened, before the Wall Street Journal or Murdoch or any of the people have been able to even file a written answer to the complaint, President Trump says, I want to depose Murdoch because he's 94 years old. And Murdoch goes, it's not time. You're not going to depose me. So Trump now has a motion before the court to allow him to depose Murdoch because he's 94 years old and he might die at any minute, and he wants to preserve his testimony.
So skip over everything else. Just go
skip over all the procedures. Skip over all the preliminaries. Let's just jump. Let's just go for the gold, right?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's why it helps to have an actual lawyer representing you.
Maybe. Depositions can be considered sort of the ultimate discovery. There are a bunch of reasons for depositions. One is to gain information. But the other important aspect, I think you'd agree, Judge Gale, is to lock somebody into a story under oath.
Oh, indeed.
Prior to
get that
trial.
Testimony early. And
so it doesn't change, or if it does change at trial, you've got something concrete to show that there's been a change of testimony.
Inconsistencies, yes.
Yeah. So depositions are vitally important, and they do not have to be between the parties. The parties to the case, plaintiff, defendant, so forth. Interrogatories have to be between the parties. Depositions can be of any witness in the world that might have relevant testimony as it relates to a case. I always thought depositions were critical. I would prepare my butt off for depositions because you usually only get one chance to depose somebody. It's not like you can keep going back and forth because the court would not generally allow that. So you had to take your best shot early and get every bit of information that you could.
And remember, in addition to the court potentially not allowing it, it could be extremely cost prohibitive to attempt to depose someone more than once. Because as you said before, you're talking about oral examination or essentially oral testimony of a witness under oath, which requires a court reporter to be there, for which there is an expense related, as well as attorneys for both sides, which is, of course, an expense for their time being there. So you're absolutely right when thinking about how to use this, you know, very limited, maybe single opportunity to depose someone. You can keep them there for, you know, a considerable period of time. Just make sure you get all your good questions in and get them answered, because you do want them to be kind of tethered to that testimony that they give, and to not provide them, you know, the out or the ability to testify differently. But you also want to be careful of the amount of time that you're using, because literally time is money.
Well, you also have to pay the physician for, let's say you're taking a doctor's deposition, you have to pay their time to sit there for the deposition.
And for the love of God, don't be late.
Yeah, absolutely. If you are deposing an expert, you also have to pay for their time. If it is you're deposing one of your witnesses, you have to pay for their time and their ability to be there. Also, if it's videotaped, you have to or some kind of digitized video that can be played in the courtroom, you have to pay for technicians to do that. So these are not things that you just do devil may care. You have to put some thought into it and look at the economics of doing this. How many depositions do you really need? Who do you really need to talk with? Now, oftentimes, Judge, on a civil case, a personal injury case of some form, there will be settlement negotiations after the attending physician or the doctor or the surgeon or the experts testify, because insurance companies will evaluate that testimony and say, okay, this isn't going to look good for us in front of a jury. We'll give you X amount of settlement, or we'll up our settlement offer to X. It really, depositions go in a large part towards not only discovery and preserving testimony, but settlement.
Indeed. And it's so necessary, I think, to get all of this information together to try to achieve, because I think that's, you know, I don't know about you, Judge, I'll tell you my ultimate goal was, you know, more so to get a settlement than to try the case. So it would be music to your ears to have all of this information together and to gather it so that there are some meaningful conversations. Because there are sometimes, I think, when you might have the parties that maybe give a little lip service to the idea of a settlement, but, you know, perhaps, you know, are not sincere about it. But when there's enough evidence, information, and production of documents or digitized documentation to really have meaningful settlement conversations, I think judges are really happy because, again, as you said, in most courts, the judge has both the civil and the criminal docket. So you're required to, you got to handle this case one way or another. So if there's a way to get it done, absolutely. Let's settle it.
Attorney fees are, we were sort of joking about them earlier, but attorney fees are really important in civil cases because as opposed to a criminal case where you have a prosecutor that's paid by the state or the local municipality or the federal government, and you have a defense attorney who may be paid by the defendant, or you have a public defender that's also paid by the state, attorney fees are, I would venture to say, not as important as in a civil case. In a civil case, you have attorney fees for the plaintiff and you have attorney fees for the defendant. Now, yep. a lot of times in a civil case, the attorney for the plaintiff will take a case based on a contingent fee agreement. And what that means is the attorney says, I will take roughly 35 or 40% of whatever we get either in settlement or at trial as my fee. If we don't get anything, I don't get anything. You just have to pay the expenses, client. Mm-hmm. You know, however, the defendant, whether it's an insurance company or not, they have to pay an attorney.
That's right.
There's no contingent fee on the defense side. So attorney fees become very important in the settlement of cases.
Well, I guess that's why you fashion those interrogatories the way that you do very early on. Because you already know that this is a consideration for the defendant, that there's no contingent fee on this because there's not really anything for them to gain from it other than to have the litigation concluded. So,
well, it's part of a strategy, and it, especially in libel cases, for example, if there are things called slap suits. Are you familiar with those? I'm sure you are. You know, where the plaintiff.
Well, on my time on the bench, I dealt with a very, very dishonest local print media outfit. So I'm very familiar with how the truth is very tangentially, if ever, connected to what they actually write.
Well, what happens is that a plaintiff may file a libel suit or a defamation suit against a smaller news agency, say a local weekly or a local nonprofit or whatever, not against the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, as Trump has done, but the lower level and medium level news organizations. And with the expectation, not necessarily of winning the case at trial, but running up the attorney fees to the point where it's more advantageous for the small media outlet.
Yep, to resolve it than to fight it.
To settle the case than to fight it. I can pay this, the news organization may say, I can pay this person off by giving them $200,000, or I can spend $1 million in attorney fees and may still lose the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
so
a
the
factor.
Math becomes very simple.
Well, that's a factor in civil cases that we don't have in criminal cases.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Well, although there are some, I think there are different considerations in criminal cases, but you're absolutely right. Money is often the driving factor. But remember that, you know, most civil cases revolve around or are to some degree related to money or a financial resolution. That's why I call them the pocketbook cases, because it's more often than not related to the pocketbook or the wallet and how that gets resolved. So you're right. And I think from the beginning, at the time of filing, there's always the consideration of, you know, how is this going to, from an attorney's perspective. How is this going to financially impact my client, whether you're the plaintiff's attorney or the defense attorney?
Another factor in cases taking, civil cases taking so long is, I think, a factor that has been built into the system, both in federal and state court levels, that was built in to expedite the resolution of civil cases, but often it does not. And that is the whole idea of mediation, court-ordered mediation, or court-ordered arbitration. Can you talk about that a bit?
Meaning the difference between arbitration and mediation.
Well, no, just the concept of the courts basically bringing in somebody from the outside to see if they can't reach a settlement of a case way early.
Oh, yes. And you know what? That's not uncommon. It is so necessary. I think it goes also to a point that you raised earlier, maybe in our discussion here, is the fact that many courts are struggling with backlog. And there are always going to be way more cases than there are judges. And that's just a fact. But in order to, and that also speaks to why it takes often so long to resolve a matter. But when the court can rely upon a disinterested party, a mediator or arbitrator, to come in and to speak to the parties in an effort to resolve the case early on, very early on, I think it works to the benefit of all involved. And that is not an uncommon practice. And in fact, in some jurisdictions,
it's required.
The parties, right? It is required that be a step that's taken, but also you'll often have the parties that request that as well. There are other jurisdictions, believe it or not, Judge, where you can actually hire a private judge, which kind of works similar to this, to resolve the matter for the parties as well, especially if they've kind of gotten to a sticking point and the judge that otherwise would have been assigned does not have the benefit of additional time or staff or even bandwidth to give to this particular case, the parties might,
judge.
Yeah, they might find it advantageous to do that.
That is an alternative to mediation and arbitration. Mediation and arbitration, the parties have to come to a resolution. If you use a rent-a-judge, so to speak, have documents where basically that judge conducts a trial and that judge's ruling is the ruling in the case. You agree to that ahead of time instead of we have to arrive at a settlement. That's a major difference.
No, yep, you're right.
So that's why civil cases take 2.7 years, two years and 7 months. And we've only hit the high points. I think the biggest aspect is discovery takes a long time in complicated cases. The number of parties involved in a single case, the higher the number, the longer it takes. I sort of, as a judge, came to the conclusion, Judge Gale, that there's no simple civil case. You know, I found sometimes there were simple criminal cases, but civil cases always seem to have multiple layers to them.
That's true.
did you find that? I mean,
absolutely. As complex as they are, right? You're just like, it just adds to the complexity of the actual cases themselves, the fact that they have all these layers, they're all of these parties. I think the parties add to the layers. And let's not forget all the personalities that are included as part of that.
Yeah. And as a judge, I felt more, and maybe this is just me, but I felt more adept and more at ease handling criminal matters than I did civil matters. Because civil matters were out of my comfort zone. You know, as a former defense attorney who took the bench, I understood the courtroom. I understood criminal law from, I think, all aspects. A civil case, every civil case you get is different.
Yes.
And has different requirements of you as a judge to be able to make reasonable and rational and judicial and judicious decisions. And I just didn't feel that comfortable with them.
I absolutely agree. And I have to ask you, how did you feel about this? But I tended to find as a judge that the attorneys in civil cases were far more mean than the attorneys even in criminal cases.
Oh, they are.
Were, oh my gosh.
They're usually from big firms that have multiple assets, hundreds of paralegals. They can just paper you to death,
yes,
so to speak.
Death by a thousand paper cuts.
Now it's just all digitized, but that's part of the strategy. You know, we were joking about my interrogatories, but that's part of the strategy. Paper somebody to death, run up their fees, mm-hmm, make them want to settle early by making things hurt. And big firms are so adept at that. And you're right, they're mean as snakes.
They are. I mean, they would, if you read the motions, oh my gosh, they were very prone to insulting their colleagues, and they would absolutely, they would not care. They had like no misgivings about being insulting or being extremely nasty. And again, we were just talking about money, whereas I saw attorneys whose clients, you know, when a prosecutor, you got clients whose lives are on the line, and they were, yeah, a lot more congenial,
a lot more cordial. And
yes, yes, they would be far more likely to be, you know, willing to negotiate or to just be cordial than attorneys who were literally there fighting over. Yeah, and mind you, we weren't talking small dollars. So oftentimes there's a lot, yeah, of money that's on the line. But money notwithstanding, the attitude difference was just something I just don't know that I'd seen before.
Well, for our audience, look for the new developments in Trump versus the Wall Street Journal. And Mr. Murdoch, the owner of the Wall Street Journal, let's see if President Trump continues to represent himself in this case. And also see if the judge allows the deposition of 94-year-old Murdoch early, or whether the judge says, wait your turn, dude.
Yes.
All things come in good time. Hey, how do people find us?
Well, we look forward to you continuing to support us, especially with NPR Radio. We are so grateful that NPR has continued to be just a wonderful partner to us. So you can check us out anywhere you find your favorite podcasts on NPR. And if you look for podcasts elsewhere, then you can find us on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon. We are so delighted to continue to bring you this fantastic content. And we like to say, you don't trust what you don't understand. So our goal is that we have increased your understanding so that you will trust us more. Thank you so much for your support.
Absolutely. That is our goal, to build your trust and understanding. If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can always email it to me at my email address, Hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, Hodson, at ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics that you would like for us to cover in the future, drop me an email and we'll add your topic to our list of upcoming shows. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer and recent Emmy Award winner.
Yay! Congratulations!
For work he's done at WOUB in post-production audio. Judge Gale and I will be back to give you more insights into the law real soon. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.